Welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. Today I went on an exploration with Jonathan Peugeot. Jonathan is a professional icon carver and the editor and contributor to the Orthodox Arts Journal. He's also a public speaker and a YouTuber exploring symbolism through his channel, The Symbolic World. It was a little bit of a whirlwind of an exploration as we discussed Orthodox Christianity, participatory art, Pepe the Frog, polarization and fragmentation of the culture war, Jordan Peterson, the spectacle, LARPing community and meeting, clown world, Trump as the sacred clown and apex narcissist, the acceleration of the honk pill, Bruce V's conversion to Orthodox Christianity, Christianity as a new punk, cancel culture, cancel God, and cannibal babies. So hopefully that's enough for you guys to chew on for one episode. If you have any questions or comments on this episode or the podcast in general, feel free to add and message me on Twitter at Peter N. Lindberg. All right, enjoy this exploration I had with Jonathan. Today, I'm exploring with Jonathan Peugeot. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset. My intention is to engage in this dialogue with the spirit of exploration. I'm not here to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together. That being said, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I want to discuss culture war happenings with you, maybe from a symbolic perspective. But first, I was thinking I can inquire into your background. You're a professional icon carver who carves Eastern Orthodox icons and other traditional Christian images. And I'm curious how you got into that line of work.
Well, I studied as an artist in college, contemporary art, postmodern art. But I quickly came to the end of that, I guess. I ran out of steam in that world. and I actually, through a general spiritual crisis and an art crisis at the same time, is when I discovered the traditional language of Christian art. You know, at first it was really just this medieval language that had been universal in the church from, I always tell people, if you had gone into any church in the world in the year 1100 or 1200, you would have seen essentially the same thing. And that language had kind of developed organically within Christianity. And so I discovered that language as a kind of sacred algebra, you could call it, a way to frame the world. And I was fascinated by it. It was something that I felt like I'd been looking for my whole life. And so I plunged into that. Mm-hmm.
And can you kind of speak on that spiritual crisis?
Well, I grew up in an evangelical. My parents had converted from Catholicism to the evangelical church in the 1970s. You know, kind of just 60s, 70s happened everywhere, and that upheaval. And so part of the people in Quebec, here in Quebec, it was the most Catholic place in the world at that time. And when that happened, there was, people went on all every direction. Some people left the church completely. Some people became Catholic, but very liberal. And then some people, you know, changed and became Protestant. So my parents were part of those that discovered the message, the evangelical freshness, you could say, you know, this kind of immediate message about the gospel. And so they became evangelical. But myself, when I came into my 20s, going to college, reading philosophy, reading also writing from other traditions, especially mystical writings, I really felt like there was something lacking in my surroundings. And then again, that's when I discovered the church fathers. I read St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. Maximus the Confessor. These writers really helped me to see that Christianity is not just a bunch of arbitrary things that you believe, but it's actually talking about the shape of the world and how we exist in it. And that was a moment of a real enlightening moment. And then, so it all went together, the art, but then also understanding the theology, and then ultimately also understanding the symbolism, which was in the art, in the typology, in the analogies used by the fathers, really as this kind of language which grounds reality, a narrative language or analogical language which creates the frame by which we then view facts, by which we then understand our own values.
As I mentioned to you, I was baptized as Eastern Orthodox, and I stepped away from it. But recently, I'm being drawn to it again. And I really appreciate the kind of the mystical and spiritual aspects of it. So I was wondering if you could kind of speak on that. How does it spiritually show up in your life?
Well, I think that for me, at least, you know, I'm still, how can I say this? I'm still a kind of Western intellectual in the worst sense of that. You know, I think that the way that it grounds it most immediately for me is this frame that I'm talking about, is a understanding that I need, or that we need a frame in order to perceive reality, in order to engage with reality. And so the storytelling in scriptures, and which comes out in images, in the icons, in the liturgy, all of these things together, the principles of architecture, all of that has become for me a theory of reality, you know, let's say a manner in which the world, understanding how the world lays itself out in front of us. And so for me, that has been extremely meaningful, because it's not only a theory in the sense that it's not just a bunch of things that you think, but it also becomes something that you can get engaged in. And it becomes existential, to the extent that it's your story as well. It's not just a story that I'm looking at from the outside. I always tell people that we need to participate in the story. We're so used to entertainment culture and to in the kind of pure aesthetic experiences that we forget how traditional culture is a participative tradition. And so I think but it's a struggle in the modern world, let's be honest. You know, the world is so fragmented and our communities are fragmented. Everybody is far away from each other. And so it's a constant struggle. It's a constant fight to try to maintain a sense of being connected to that story.
Right. And I'm curious, when I started researching Orthodox Christianity again, I was kind of impressed or appreciative of the kind of panentheistic frame. And did that have any impact on you, that kind of that switch or residing in that from your previous Christian roots?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that just the idea, you know, it's so hard when you're in the evangelical world, they don't talk about questions of metaphysics or ontology. Mm-hmm. And I think that just understanding that Christianity is talking about ontology, you know, and just the idea of the logos is addressing the questions of ontology. And so St. Maximus the Confessor, who is a 7th century saint, really lays it out beautifully how the divine logi, or the purposes, the invisible purposes, are hidden in the world and are that which hold the world together. And then those are gathered into the human person. And so all of that, for me, like you said, what it does is it shows us the manner in which God is both absolutely transcendent and then, but also absolutely immanent. Like those two things are almost become necessarily linked together.
Right. And, you know, your YouTube channel, The Symbolic World, you talk a lot about symbolism. And I'm curious how you got into that.
But I think that it really does have to do with a kind of ontology, understanding how the world exists and understanding how it lays itself out. What I started to notice is these patterns. And it's funny, because it started reading postmodern philosophy. When I was in college, I was really into to Jacques Derrida, especially.
Right.
And it's actually Jacques Derrida who opened my eyes up to a different way of viewing the world, you know, a way which, although he was trying to deconstruct, because he was talking about the margin and trying to deconstruct the center, it gave me a real insight into what the margin is and what it is ontologically, you would say. And then after that, moving back to the center, I guess you could say, is what ended up happening. And then understanding the traditional metaphysics of Christianity.
And so I got introduced to you, and I think a lot of people got introduced to you from Jordan Peterson, and then that kind of epic interview you had on the metaphysics of Pepe.
Yeah.
So And I think that was your first kind of video on your YouTube channel, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think it wasn't my first video on my YouTube channel, but it was the one that definitely attracted attention.
Right. And so like, and maybe we can use this as a launching point to talk about culture war happenings and what your current interest is in it and the fragmentation of it all. But like, how did Pepe get on your radar?
Well, I mean, I think that, like I said, like I was talking about before, you know, that this idea that I kind of came at symbolism through postmodernism at first. And then I started to understand traditional symbolism in terms of the analogies that are in stories, the patterns that are in stories and everything. And so when Jordan Peterson had that weird Pepe moment where he became identified with this frog, I right away had the intuition that it was significant. It was significant because of just what that imagery was suggesting in terms of, you know, what Pepe the Frog was manifesting, the idea of the amphibian, you know, the idea of this image, which is a shapeshifter. All of this was talking about the problem of periphery. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to do with Jordan in that first video was try to talk about the notion of, if you watch that video, there's actually two parts. The first part, it's called, I think it's called Tradition and Exception or something like that, or Things That Don't Fit. And I wanted to help people understand the moment we're in culturally, all these small identities which are popping up, you know, this idea of these variant sexualities, these variant identities, all of this is part of the margin. And if you ask, you know, if you ask even those communities, they understand themselves as part of the margin. They understand that that's the strength that they have. That's also the difficulty that they have, is to be margin, to be on the margins. So I wanted to help people understand the margins in a total way, because one of the problems we've had in terms of understanding marginality is that we either see it as good or bad. And, you know, and I really, if anybody's watched my videos, I really struggle with those easy definitions. You know, mm-hmm. Ontologically, the margin has a place and has a function, and that function can be positive or negative depending on what's going on. And so what I wanted to do was to try to explain marginality, explain the periphery, explain the edge in a way that was showing both its positive and negative aspects, you could say. Mm.
And if to elaborate on that, what's your read on this whole culture war that's happening right now?
Yeah. Well, I think that what we're seeing played out, and I think Nietzsche was right, and that we're seeing the breakdown of Christianity play itself out. Mm. And so that happens, you know, it happens in a way where we see this fragmentation, an increased fragmentation in the discourse, in the identities. All of that is going on, but then also a desire to compensate for that fragmentation by, you know, identitarian force, you would say, you mm. know. And so, you know, the totalitarian tendency, or the, you know, the tyrannical tendency comes in relationship to the breakdown as well. That is, those two come together. You know, Plato saw right at the beginning of this whole story of ours that tyranny and democracy are, you know, they're the best friends, because one gives way to the other. Where if you go too far in liberty, then people all of a sudden see the downsides of liberty and they want a strong man to come and, you know, fix their problems. And so we see that the modern world as this constant play between those two tendencies, where things seems to shift between fragmentation and then overcompensation on the other side. And then sometimes one becomes the other. You see one thing go to fragmentation and then become its enemy, you could say. I think most people have noticed that, how this whole joke about how now it's the supposedly the right that's for free speech, and it's the left that's for censorship. Whereas, you know, just in the 1960s, you would have said the different, you would have said the opposite. And so the left has become more tyrannical. And then the right, because it's losing the culture war, has now taken a guerrilla warfare, revolutionary, you know, kind of approach to culture, where they act as anarchists almost, but they're supposed to be the right. You know, figures in the figures like Gavin McGinnis or Milo Yiannopoulos, those kinds of figures, they could not have existed even just, you know, 20 years ago. There's no way those figures could have existed on the social horizon.
Right. Like, and I want to talk, I watched a video of yours where you talk about entertainment versus culture, and maybe I want to double click on that in a moment, but just, I kind of want to like get your thoughts on this, because there's one hand, there's this idea that we're polarized, right? Which indicates that there's two sides. And you mentioned the left and right, people like Jordan Hall called the blue church, red church. And there's a sense, at least on the felt level sense, there's, you know, this kind of like a spiritual polarization, but then on the other hand, also seems like a fragmentation. And then our white paper talked about this, or all these kind of like mini memetic tribes that are kind of had these odd alliances and they're fighting against each other. And nobody knows where the lines are in the battlefield.
Yeah. There, if you think of it simply as like an ontological structure, you can see that they're inevitable, because as soon as dualism enters the picture, as soon as we take a dualistic approach, then the inevitable result of that is ultimately fragmentation. It doesn't happen right away, but it will lead to fragmentation, because in reality, there has to be a central point which unifies things together. And so in the story of Genesis, you see in the story of Adam and Eve, for example, in the Garden of Eden, you see exactly that, where they're in this garden, this central space, and then they give in to duality. They eat the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And by giving in to duality as their first principle, you could say, then they are chased from the garden and they go into the world of thorns and the world of hostility, the world of death. And death is decomposition. That is the best definition of death. It is when things decompose. And so as soon as you can imagine it like this, like you can imagine it as a family. Let's say a family with many children, and the couple starts to fight amongst themselves. And as the couple starts to fight amongst themselves, what will inevitably happen is that the children are going to start to fight amongst themselves. And before very long, the whole thing is going to be a mess, because the children are looking to the parents, and the parents should be looking to a unified principle, to their covenant, to what it is that unifies them together. And so as soon as we fall into dualism, then after a while, we end up with fragmentation.
In guys like Jordan Peterson, what do you think his role in the culture war is? Because, you know, he's kind of lumped in at this alt-centrist type of crowd. And what's your take on that?
I think that, you know, I think like you, I know Jordan, and I met him before all of this, and I was really impressed by some of the things that he was saying. I think that there's a lot of good in what Jordan is doing. I think that moving people away from the desire to change the world and to, let's say, project the problems always onto the other, onto this vague social sphere, and rather taking things on yourself and trying to fix yourself, I think that is the right move. I think it's, even though Jordan doesn't specifically identify as a Christian, I think that that is the Christian move. Is to change yourself. You know, that there's great quote by Saint Seraphim of Sarov, which says, acquire the spirit of peace and thousands around you will be saved, because that's how the world works. You know, if you become a centered person, if you become someone who has found balance in your life, then that will have repercussions all over. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I think that Jordan is playing a positive role in that sense, where he's telling people to first look at themselves before trying to change everything around them.
Right. Like, what is your sense of where things are going? And I'm sort of like, I'm reading Alexander Dugin's The Fourth Political Theory right now. I'm part of this reading group. And so like my head is in this trying to grok what he's trying to get at, how there's like, you know, he's trying to aim for a multipolar kind of world order. And the argument there is that there's currently this like woke neoliberals that are trying to impose themselves on the geopolitical sphere and maybe trying to capture the meta narrative. So what do you think things are going in the culture war?
I honestly don't see things getting any better anytime soon. I hate to be a pessimist.
Great.
To be honest, I tried to focus on, like I said, I tried to focus on awakening people to the symbolic meaning, and and hoping that it transforms their lives. But when I look at the social horizon, I look at the signs, let's say the signs of the times would call them.
Right.
I have to say that we are standing in Weimar Germany. Like everything is there. Everything that was there before World War II is there again. And I think we didn't learn a single lesson from World War II because we didn't want to deal with some of the difficult problems that came out of the war and came out of the results of the war, including our alliance with Russia, with the communists, all of that we don't want to look at. We don't even want to talk about it. We can't. It's like a weird blind spot. So because of that, we are standing there right again on the same cusp, although now it's times 100. Now it's times 1,000. And so it really doesn't look good, I have to admit. sorry to be so
No, let's dive into that pessimism. And maybe we can kind of go with the entertainment versus culture piece that you were talking about in one of your videos. Could you explain to the people who haven't watched it what you meant by that?
In the ancient world, let's say, in the ancient world, the culture or art, let's say, art was, it was not at all that the way that we perceive art today in this kind of Kantian way, where we have this notion of a pure aesthetic experience and we are spectators. We've reduced culture to spectator sport. Mm. And so we're so far from it that we forget that traditional culture was always participative, you know, and was let's say the liturgical year or the celebration of certain feasts during the year. You had May Day and you had Christmas and you had Christian feasts and you had even older feasts that were kind of even preserved. And so culture was always participative. And now what we've done is we've reduced culture to entertainment almost. Not completely. It's interesting because if you look at this, the few things that are still celebrated, there are very few. For example, Pride is one of them, seems to be one of the only ones that is still an actual participative event. And there are very few others. There's a Christmas, but it's been turned into a weird consumer, a weird moment of consuming. Even Thanksgiving has been made dark by Black Friday. So all these, so it's like the last participative events we have are this weird consumption and then this weird celebration of sexual diversity. And so we don't have things that, we no longer have things that bring us together, that create a sense that we're in it together. Because if you look at, and what we've done is we were touting TV and movies and even gallery art is all just, it's not participative. It's just even going to concerts, going to plays, we can go to the most cultural elite events, but we have to realize that it's all spectator sports. It's all a form of spectacle. And so that's what we've reduced culture to. And we need participative events. And what I'm seeing too, and this is what I talked about in this recent talk that I gave, is that what I'm seeing is that people are so hungry for participation that they're actually trying to transform spectator traditions into spectator experience into participative events where they have Harry Potter churches and those old, I forget the name of the movie. They used to have that where people would dress up and go to that
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, so Rocky Horror Picture Show was like the first glimpse of that, which kind of fed into Pride celebration. But now, you know, people are doing it with cosplay or doing it with Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, all of that. And because they're hungry for participation. And I can't blame them for that. But we have nothing richer or more cohesive to offer people anymore.
It's like the whole LARPing movement where people go in the woods, dress as knights and stuff like that and role play.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something rather, on this one hand, I understand it. Like I have sympathy for that. But there's also something sad and adolescent about it at the same time. So my contention is that this whole all these movements are parodies of a traditional culture.
Right,
say
right.
In the West, it would have been the liturgical year where we celebrate Pentecost and Ascension and all these saints' days, which mark time, which qualify time in the year, celebrate all these harvest festivals and all these types of festivals. So now it's kind of like a pale imitation of of those moments that were there to bring us together as society.
Yeah, and I like that a lot. And what comes to mind is, you know, Guy Debord's the spectacle, the idea of the spectacle. And even in like the, here in Toronto, like the Raptors, Toronto Raptors, they won. But that's like a spectators, you know, they're going, everyone's getting kind of this feeling of community off a spectacle in a way. Yeah. And there's this term that Connor and I, the collaborator on that white paper, were doing a follow-up, and we mentioned this idea of like the outrage porno.
Yeah.
Right. Like our culture is no longer a culture. It's like an outrage porno. And it really makes you impotent, you know, because you're not really like having idea sex. You're having like, you're jerking off to ideas in a way.
That's a good way to understand it. Yeah. And but for sure, social media itself is the epitome of all of this because,
right.
Because social media has created a space where we can all be players on a stage and we all have spectators. And so we're actually not in relationships. We're performing and we're being watched. And that's it. And it's we're doing that to each other. So it's brought about spectator culture to your living room, to the micro level. And sadly, people are confusing that with actual community, confusing that with actual relationships.
And do you have any idea, like you mentioned the sort of the LARPing example, but do you have any idea how genuine community can make a comeback?
I'm gonna go the Jordan Peterson route. There's no other way to do it. Is get involved in your family, you know, get involved in the people that are nearby around you, get involved in your in the communities around you. It helps. I mean, I'm lucky because I go to church and I have I have to face people. Family and church are really great because you don't choose those people. Well, you choose your spouse, hopefully, but you don't choose your kids. You don't choose your parents. You don't choose your you don't choose the people that are in your church. And so what ends up happening is you have to have a very wide cross cut of types of people that you have to interact with. And so it creates actual community. And it also creates actual antibodies in yourself in dealing with people that are different from you, have different opinions, right, have different right. Approaches to reality. Whereas the let's say the work community can be extremely deceptive because you do end up being with usually with people of your own social class, people of your usually of similar opinions than you. And the same with these online communities. The online communities are the worst because you end up gravitating to people that think like you, and the social media platforms are there to make that even more prevalent because they just want to keep you on there.
And you did a few videos on the clown world, which is related to, you know, the spectacle and all this type of stuff. Could you speak on that? Like,
what is clown world?
Yeah. Well, what is clown world? And then what's your take on it?
I mean, clown world is a meme that appeared a while ago, actually. Someone had pointed it to me like a year ago, even more than a year ago. But then it exploded in the recent month because someone wrote an article in the New York Times or some, I don't forget which big newspaper, calling it out as Nazi. And then all of a sudden, then everybody wanted to use it just to, you know, just to thumb their nose at these big agent news agencies that, that are trying to tell us what to think and who to be. And so, then I've been thinking a lot about the clown for several years. I've been thinking about the clown in terms of not just the clown, but the carnival and what we'd call social rituals of inversion. And so all cultures have inversion events or rituals of inversions. We still have Halloween is like our last remainder of that, but ancient medieval culture had things called like the Feast of Fools, where during the year, one day during the year, a fool would be elected as a kind of mock king. And then during the day, everybody would do things upside down. The Jews have Purim, where they dress up and they, you know, they're supposed to, there's a rabbinical saying that says that on Purim, you have to get drunk. You have to drink enough that you would fall down. And so these rituals of inversions are important because what they do is they mark the limit of something. They mark the upside down because you only know something is straight if you've known what is crooked. Like you only know what is cohesive if you've seen what is the breakdown. And so by giving societies having these little valves of upside down, you know, they were able to, first of all, let off some of the chaotic pressure that builds up if you have a system that's too orderly. So you kind of have one day a year or a few days a year or a week a right. year where you can kind of let some of that steam out, you know, that accumulated chaos. And then it also marks the center. It also tells you what normal world is. And so what's happening today is that it seems like our entire world is a carnival and has actually taken carnival imagery, you know, in its manifestations, you know. And so upside down, acting upside down, also this obsession with entertainment and laughter, and even the speeding up of things is something which is very carnivalesque. I've been trying to point to people to look at county fairs as almost these kind of perfect ontological manifestations of this phenomena, which is the edge, the inversion, eating only candy, you know, eating only sugar, drinking, all these things which happen, which kind of lead to dissolution or on the edge, or only about, you know, being garish, being wearing costumes, pretending to be something else. All of that is related to the carnival. I mean, if I just say carnival, think of all the images that happen in your mind, and you can see it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then the freak shows that were part of carnivals as well. All these exceptions, these monsters, things that were there to surprise and titillate, and show you also what remind you also of what is normal by showing you things that are different. Mm. And so what's going on today is that, like I said, seems like our entire culture has become a carnival culture. And so that's what the clown world meme is about. And my contention, which I've had for several years, is that when the world is upside down, the trickster is the one who puts it right side up. Mm-hmm. So the trickster is actually the one to make the world upside down. The trickster, that's what the trickster is always doing. But when the world ends up upside down, then the clown, the trickster, the joker is the one that will, the trump card is the one that will make things, will bring things back to what they're supposed to be. Mm. And so I've been kind of touting laughter as a way to put things back on their feet, because when the upside down, which is there to provoke laughter, I mean, the upside down is supposed to be there to provoke laughter. But then when the upside down is trying to impose itself as being normative, and you laugh at that, mm. oh my goodness, then then it's the ultimate contradiction. And that's when I think that things can possibly flip right side up, at least intuit to people that they're upside down. They can at least see that they're upside down when you start to laugh at something that's upside down, and the upside down thing will get angry at you because you're laughing at that which has always been there to provoke laughter.
Mm. Is this a few things came to mind. You mentioned the trump card, and I read this article is an interesting article. They said that Trump was the embodiment of the OK. I think that's how you pronounce it. Yep. The Native yep. American kind of yep. trickster
yep.
Archetype.
Yep.
Have you came across that theory? And if so, what's your thoughts on it?
I think that it's possible. I think that it's possible to the extent that you also understand how the heyoke is annoying. Mm. Because one of the problems that people will idealize these figures, especially in the kind of 60s hippie culture, where we idealize the holy fool, but the holy fool is really annoying, because the holy fool will, you know, the holy fools would, they'd go to rituals and fart during rituals and would do things to break the orderly, you know, proceedings. And so if you can understand how the trickster Hayoke figure is annoying, then you can see Trump as doing that, and it's disruptive, you know. I'm not sure about Trump. Like, he definitely has that. Like, he was a professional wrestler, you know. Yeah, he yeah. was he has a caricature aspect to himself. Like, he's he seems like he's a caricature of himself, that he's also played that up in himself. Mm-hmm. And so, but I don't know. To be honest, I don't totally know the ultimate effect of what it might actually end up being worse, because he seems to be making people insane. Mm. And so by making people insane, when those insane people take power eventually, because the United States democracy is meant to eventually swing back to the other side, when the insane people take power, it might be the most frightening time in history. Mm. So I'm not sure. Like, I'm not totally sure about him and the effect that he's having. I would say best case scenario, he's something of a King David figure, in the sense that he is this kind of weird guy who acts crazy and who's an entertainer, just like King David, you know, who takes other people's wives like King David did, who does all these things that are totally weird and not acceptable, but is somehow able to flip it back into, you know, making Jerusalem the central place again, you know. Mm. And so, you know, that's the best case scenario. And I say that not even just realizing that he made Jerusalem the capital of Israel. Okay, but that, despite the politics of that, like, let's say the symbolism, that's the best case scenario. Worst case scenario is that he's just a fool, and that it's going to spark a tyrannical response, and then we're going to see some craziness in the next swing.
Mm-hmm. What came to mind is that there's this tweet that I appreciate. I forget who did it, but they said that one of the kind of the weapons that the progressivist left uses is shame, right? They shame if you're problematic or whatever. Yeah. But in Trump, they created a shame resistant superbug.
That's right.
And then there's like an anti-fragility there, at least when it comes to impression management. Like, it's almost like he doesn't care.
That's for sure. It is. The weird thing is that he really does care, though.
Yeah.
He really, really, really does care. But just like people, it's just like Eminem. When Eminem was popular, I kept thinking Eminem is the person who cares the most what people think of him. And that's why he keeps telling people that he doesn't care. He's always telling people, you know, like, "Oh, fuck you, I don't care what you think about me." But it's like, yeah, okay, stop saying it, buddy. Why are you constantly telling us that you don't care? And so I think Trump has a little bit of that, where I think that because he in a way he cares so much what people think of him, that out of bravado, he then wants to defy that, you know, and constantly push against it. I don't want to psychoanalyze him, but it seems obvious that he cares what people think, because he's always talking about the ratings of his events and how so many people watched it and all that.
I was, I have a bunch of articles in the pipeline. They're all like super speculative. And this is one that I was thinking of, but probably gonna get me in trouble if I do write it with both sides. But like the idea that Trump is the apex narcissist, right? Like his name is on everyone's lips, on everyone's mouth type of thing. And, you know, if you're a narcissist, then all you want is attention. You want to win. You want to dominate. Yeah. You want to be the alpha male in the attention economy. And then if it's true what the studies are saying, that everyone's becoming more narcissistic, and then maybe there's just this mad jealousy towards his success at being a narcissist.
That's hilarious. For sure he's a narcissist. For sure he's a narcissist, in the sense that I hadn't thought about that. Maybe that in the end, even though he might not consciously be aware of it, that he just wants the attention, positive or negative, he'll take it. As long as you're talking about him, you know, that's good enough for him. So that's possible. I have to say that, you know, even though as a personally, I find him unsavory as a person, let's just say that I have to look around and notice that, you know, nothing happened. I mean, things are fine in the United States, and the economy is okay. And we seem to be there. The Americans seem to be in less wars than they've ever been since World War II or whatever. You know, there isn't mass every president has had this mass conflict that they've either publicly or, you know, subtly created. And so, you know, we had to deal with Libya and the Ukraine and all these ISIS and all of that during Obama. And then when Obama goes away, within like 2 weeks after Obama goes away, we never hear about ISIS again. Mm. It's like as if ISIS vanished. And now we like, who knows, who hears anything about ISIS? And so at the same time, it's like, I don't know what's going on in the people who speculate about what's actually happening, but it seems like nothing extremely bad has happened. So, you know, there's that for sure.
On the geopolitical level. Yeah. And, you know, returning to the clown world, there's, you know, I'm sure you heard of the whole honk pill.
Yeah.
Right. And then, I think you can map this over like the five stages of grief, all those sort of the reactionary pills, like the blue pills, denial, the red pills, right. Anger, the gray pills, negotiation. And then, the black pill is like despair. And then, the honk pill is acceptance, right? but there's a dark nihilistic kind of essence about people who are, you know, honk pilling, or at least passing around the meme. So yeah. I wonder if you have any thoughts about the dark element there, and then sort of this weird acceptance.
Yeah, I think that we have to be careful in that sense, because there is also in the honk pill or in this clown world meme, there is an accelerationist tendency. And I don't think that that's useful. And I made a video about that, about accelerationism, because I think that being an accelerationist and engaging in that type of behavior is dangerous for your own self. Like it's actually dangerous for your soul to want to see Western society collapse, you know, out of this kind of disgust or despair at seeing it so decadent. You know, I don't think that's the right way to go. You know, Christ said, you know, there will be scandal, but woe to those by whom the scandal comes. And I think that that's a way to live your life, is that you can notice the scandal and you can kind of see how things are crazy or things are upside down and all that. But to encourage that or to play that up is not great. But I think that the most positive aspect of the honk pill or the clown meme, it really is this recapturing the clown recapturing the clown for a marker of community or a marker of society or a marker of bringing things back on their feet, like flipping things back right side up. Like one of the things that you see in this kind of weird clown world thing is people say reclaiming the rainbow. And it's like, I kind of understand that. Like I understand it in the sense of saying that the rainbow is a powerful traditional image, which does talk about the margin, actually, which actually is talking about this ocean of multiplicity and the edge, but that it has to be seen as part of a greater context, which is, it has to be part of a, you know, in a normal world, there is also the fringe. In a normal world, there is also the margin. And we have to not cut off the margin. It has to be part of the whole story. Mm-hmm. The problem now is that we put the margin in the center, and that doesn't work, it's going to fall apart. So I think the positive aspect of the clown world, that would be it. But also not letting it get to you. People get so dark and so, you know, I don't understand. There's no reason. It's not helpful for you to let this destroy you, to look around and to let the social, you know, breakdown to destroy you personally. On the other, you know, it's the opposite. You should try to act as a bulwark in your own life to that chaos.
Right. And would you say, what just came to mind is like, could you bifurcate the clown, right? There's maybe the positive version of the clown, like a restorative version that lets off that steam. And then it's like
and there's a Joker.
Yeah. And there's like the Joker, you know, like the actual movie, the Joker, where it's like a clown. Yeah. The hellish clown, right.
Yeah.
That wants chaos for its own sake, wants to increase suffering, and then kind of like laughs all the way to hell.
Yeah, no, I agree. But the thing is that all symbolism is like that. All symbolism has two sides. You know, a symbol only shows its place in an ontological structure, but then the direction it will take can depend. And so it doesn't. I don't know if that makes sense to you. Is that there are sometimes, let's say you have a symbolism of centralization or symbolism of fragmentation or multiplication, then multiplication is not bad in itself, and centralization is not bad or good in itself either. Mm-hmm. It just depends. And so the idea of the clown or the jester or the trickster is like all symbolism. It's neutral, and it can be used for ill or for good. And so we can bifurcate it in understanding, but ultimately the symbol will always have those two sides within it. The clown, you can't make just a nice clown. The dark clown is always there. You just have to understand the clown well enough in order to, let's say, emphasize the good parts or ride the good parts and at least be aware of the darker parts as well.
Right. So finally, fine game or fine ride.
Oh, for sure. It's like that for everything. You know, it's like that for any, like I said, even the idea of centralization or moving towards identity, it can be really great, you know, because you can discover who you are. You can discover your history, your origin, your family, what it is that unites your community. It can be wonderful. Then it can also be really dangerous because that's the same mechanism which makes you dehumanize those that aren't in your identity. Mm-hmm. And so those two things are always there. And then it's the same with multiplication. Multiplication is great because diversity gives room for more, increases our potentiality. Then it also is a breakdown, and it will pull apart the center. And it will create confusion and ultimately chaos. So it's like that for everything.
Mm. So you tweeted out that an example of Clown World is Rouge V, the kind of the Manosphere chief.
Yeah.
How he was, so he's part of the Manosphere. So it's like an aggressive sort of aggressive criticism against feminism and sort of like in a very trollish way. And then he advocated just to like, you know, has sex with as many as possible, travel all over the world, all that type of stuff. And then he had I don't know if it was an LSD experience, but he had a psychedelic experience. And then he had it was a religious to him. And then he converted to, or maybe he rediscovered his Orthodox Christian roots. So,
every time I hear that story, I laugh. But that's not the most of it. The most of it is that then he went back onto his own forums.
Right, right.
And then he said that people are not allowed to talk about pickup culture. And then he unpublished his books.
Right. His
pickup books guys. On his pickup culture. So
Yeah.
That is intense. I mean, that is really, like I said, that really is it really is an image of Clown World, or how Clown World can have a positive effect, where the person who is cynically poking fun at society, cynically trolling it, cynically using the fact that women have emancipated themselves to gratify his own pleasure, all of that is who he was. And then all of a sudden, that very process led him to flip, to flip completely. And then want to encourage real relationships, want to encourage marriage, and then go back to the Christian story. You see similar versions of that in someone like Gavin McGinnis. You know, he has a video. One of his videos it says something like, "Church is great. It's just like sex," and it's like, and you can just see that Gavin is like a punk. He's such a punk. I mean, he created Vice. He has a punk underpinning, but it, that very process going to the end of it has led him back to, you know, being married, having children, being a Knights of Columbus of all things, you know, all of that. So I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see that more and more. We're going to see these figures, these kind of marginal figures flip because there's no margin anymore. You know, there's a funny meme that people were making for a while. I haven't seen it in a while, but they were making these memes, you know, where it was something like a scene from 50 Shades of Grey, where the Grey character is saying how he's really into very, very weird stuff. And the lady's like, "Oh yeah, like what?" And then you show a picture of a traditional family with a man and a woman and three kids. And it's like, that's right. I mean, that's the only place to go now. If you want to buck the system, if you want to be a rebel, the only place to go is a return towards tradition.
It's like Christianity is a new punk.
That's right. Well, you see that in you saw that in what's his name, the InfoWars guy,
Alex Jones.
Not Alex Jones, the other one. I forget his name. My goodness, it's horrible. Anyways, he did that thing like conservatism is the new counterculture. Oh, and then he did
Paul Joseph.
He did a whole series on that, and then Milo was also a manifestation of that as well. So there's quite a few of those on the horizon, and it's good to pay attention to that, because when you see the margin flipping, it can be a good sign. It can be a good sign that there's at least hope for people to find meaning and to find some kind of attachment to a center.
Right. You know, there's maybe I can get your opinion on something. There's an idea that I'm co-writing with an illustrator, Lubomir Arzov. And it's kind of the idea that cancel culture?
No.
The idea of cancel culture is amongst like the woke tribes. If someone says something problematic or racist, then you're canceled.
Right. Yeah.
And then usually a lot of BuzzFeed, Vice, they go on an attack, and then someone's livelihood is threatened, and so there's this feeling of being held hostage of speaking kind of nuance or even dangerous truths or whatever.
Yeah. Kind of a weird decentralized Maoist purge.
Right. Right. And then like even people like Kanye West said, we got to cancel culture. And even people amongst the woke communities, I read some blogs on Black Lives Matters and stuff like that. They're saying, no, this is getting out of hand. Everyone's getting canceled now. Right. Because right. even like it's like eating its own. I think
that's that the revolution eats its young.
Right. And so, and I was thinking about this, we're flirting with this article called The Cancel God. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that cancel culture got untethered from its original purpose to maintain purity amongst the woke tribes. And then there's sort of this cancel God got emerged from it, and he's just hungry to consume images.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
And then, so these like reactionary tribes are like sacrificing, like trollishly sacrificing images. Okay. Let's sacrifice the frog. Let's sacrifice the okay sign, the clowns.
Yeah. And then the 4chan group, they actually do it on purpose. They try to get things sacrificed. Like,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so like, but it's, there's an incoherent, or I'm trying to find a coherence between the how it got separated and became its own thing. But the idea is that this kind of cancel God, its telos is to cancel humanity itself.
Yeah.
Because they just want to eat. Because, if this cancel culture, nobody can really kind of communicate with each other. We can't sense make together. We can't really address all the existential risks that are threatening us.
Yeah.
Because there's like this looming cancel God. I'm curious what you think about the kind of the consumption of images in this culture that we have.
In terms of this cancel culture?
Yeah, cancel God, if there's such a thing.
I would say, if you're talking about this idea of the cancel, this cancel God that you're talking about, I would definitely look at the myth of Kronos. The myth of Saturn devouring his children for sure has always been used, to represent this problem, even during during the time of the revolution. Looking at the story of Robespierre would be helpful for you as well. I mean, you see it everywhere. You see it in the Stalinist purges as well, where it's like it becomes a self-feeding machine. The guillotine is hungry for victims. And so you end up, and then the people who were the ones doing the sacrificing get caught up in their own game, and then they end up being sacrificed. And then what ends up feeding it is also a kind of deep resentment as well. Mm. Because it's like, that's how you also attain power. Like power by canceling someone else. That's how you go up in the hierarchy. And so then, like you said, then it's about taking down the people you can. And so as soon as you expose yourself in the public discourse, even if you're canceling others, at some point, you can be eaten.
Right. And it's like Jonathan Haidt talks about, the prestige economy amongst these social justice activists. So it's like the call out, right? It's canceling someone by calling them out gets you honor, gets you status. But then it's sort of really a race to the bottom, because everyone is just like out to destroy each other.
Exactly. No, you're right.
Yeah.
And then you have to, then the people have to make atonement for their, I've been so surprised at seeing this language of atonement appear so strongly, and seeing someone who said something, a long time ago or tweeted something 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And then there's this idea that they have to atone. that they have to, it's like they really do have to like in the you know, the early modern Catholic Church or in the late medieval Catholic Church, like they have to go on their knees and go up those stairs and show everybody that they're atoning for this mishap that they've done. It's like they can't just apologize. They have to whip themselves. Like they have to create extravagant public displays of regret. You know, it's very scary. It's some scary stuff.
This article I haven't read yet. The Psychology Today called it like apocalyptic. Cancel culture is apocalyptic, which is related to this idea that we're flirting with the cancel God, and how they said that, you know, I do see the atonement aspect, but there's another aspect where if you're problematic, then you're kind of you're irredeemable. You know, you're like a basket of deplorable.
Yeah.
There's no kind of hope for you for redemption.
Yeah. No. It is a dehumanizing. It is a dehumanizing tactic as well. I mean, for sure, we've seen it. We've seen it so much now in the past few years with the way that anybody who was supporting Trump was just seen as a non-human. I mean, the fact that someone can just wear a "Make America Great Again" hat and be attacked on the street just for wearing a hat which supports a political candidate, it's crazy. Like. Yeah, when I think about that, I become extremely discouraged.
You get blackpilled.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So before we close out, is there any kind of things that are at the edge of your thinking these days?
Well, I mean, what I'm doing now really is I'm just trying to get people to see that the world is meaningful. I mean, that's really just been, I would say the crux of everything that I'm doing is to help people get back to a phenomenological approach to reality, to kind of enter back into their bodies, enter back into the way that we encounter the world, and move a little bit away from the abstract, this kind of the abstractions of scientific understanding, which are fine. I'm not against scientific understanding; it's totally valid, but getting people back into their experience and then viewing the world through the narratives, the patterns that are around them. And I, at least in my experience, that has been the most gratifying thing, is to see people who are nihilistic, who are atheistic, who are just, you know, had checked out, finally, you know, discovering how the world manifests itself through these patterns and how meaning is, not only is it there, it's inevitable. That you actually, you cannot avoid it, because you would not have experiences without meaning. Mm-hmm. Your experiences are always informed by meaning. And so to help people see that, and then to see them use that to, in a way to kind of, let's say, restructure their lives or, you know, or refocus their attention. To me, that's just been the thing that I'm most focused on. And I do it, you know, whatever way I can. I try to sometimes shock people into meaning by using images of monsters and talking about, you know, weird things to help them people see what they're, how they're meaningful. Like today, there was a thread on Twitter about cannibal babies. I don't know if you saw it.
No.
Anyways, someone was tweeting about how in the Middle Ages they were so worried about cannibals and cannibal babies. And like, imagine if two cannibals had a baby, and then that baby was also a cannibal, and then if in the resurrection, what body would that cannibal baby have? Because his body is entirely constituted from the bodies of other people, right? And so someone was mocking that so much, like, just, you know, this very woke medievalist was just going after this and how idiotic people were. And I just wanted to make a video to explain it to people, to explain why those questions are important, and why the idea of why it would be important even today to understand how incestuous relationships on several cycles without looking to the outside would eliminate body. You know, like, you can't, if you're not looking to the outside and you're only consuming inside a set, then what happens is at some point you run out of body, you know? And so it's like, I'm surprised that they can't see that that's what it's talking about. Okay, you don't like the language. You don't like that it's talking about the eschaton or the resurrection, but you cannot understand metaphysically what problem it's dealing with, and it's a problem that we would be very well to understand right now. This problem of self-eating. Anyways,
it's there's a lot of characters out there trying to solve the meeting crisis.
Yeah,
and then it seems like you're doing it in your own way through kind of inspiring people through symbols and symbolisms. I'm curious. Have you seen people who watch your videos or follow you or come to your talks? Like, what was their experience or exposure to your videos, and how did that help them nudge them towards a more meaningful life?
Well, it's funny because I get messages all the time of that story, and it's usually a similar story. It's usually they usually saw me in the Metaphysical Pepe, you know, probably like you as well, that they saw me with Jordan Peterson, and they were a bit shocked that in that video I really worked hard to try to kind of shock people into an intuition right, of meaning, right. Intuition of pattern. And so they saw that, were surprised, and started looking at my content. And like, I have an example. One of the funniest examples that I have is from this guy in Australia who wrote me, and he said, "Oh man, I love your videos. And you know, I'm really interested in what you're doing, and I'm a musician. Maybe you should check out my music." And so I click on the link that he sends me, the SoundCloud link, and he's a rave DJ.
Nice.
And he's like, it's like electronic dance music. And so I'm like, that's funny. So I just answer very politely. Then a few weeks later, he writes me again, and he says, "You know, I went to this church. You know, you talk about this Orthodox church. I went to this Orthodox church, and you know, it was like doing mushrooms, but it was even better." And then from there, then on, every few months he writes me, and then he says, "Oh, I think I shouldn't be a rave DJ anymore, because all I'm doing is taking drugs and hoping to hook up with some girl at the end of the evening." He's like, "You know, maybe I should try to do something else." And then he keeps going. After a few months, he's like, "Oh, these Christians are really nice. You know, they're not always talking about themselves and not always consumed by their own stuff." And so it's like, I can just imagine this guy, you know, with tattoos and piercings or whatever, all of a sudden, like, you know, his life just slowly transforming, and him finding some kind of purpose and meaning outside of a kind of nihilistic, you know, lifestyle. So those are the kinds of stories that really get me going.
That's great. I imagine in the 5 years that the trend keeps going like this, there's going to be an eclectic group of people in the Orthodox parishes.
That's been funny. I gave a talk in Louisiana just a few months ago, or like a month ago. And the priest told me, he looked at me and he said, "I've never seen so many atheists in my church before. Like, I don't understand what's going on." And so there was all these, it's mostly young men, you know, like young men in their 20s, 20s, 30s, who were really kind of trying to figure things out. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting. You know, I even had people come to my icon carving workshop, like 7 days of icon carving, and who are there carving, and they're like, "Oh, no, I'm not a Christian, really." Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm just kind of figuring out. I'm trying to see where it's going, but I'm interested, you know, but I'm still they're still kind of trying to think it through. So yeah, those are the kinds of people that I really like to meet.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. And how can people, you mentioned the icons, and I really enjoy, by the way, your art and your artwork. I'm thinking about purchasing one myself. How can people find what you're doing, your videos, your icons, your work, stuff like that?
So I have I basically, like, my life is split into two. So I have a website for my carvings. It's pajocarvings.com. And then I also have a website just for my media presence and YouTube and all that. It's thesymbolicworld.com. Mm. But then you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter, where I post, you know, all the stuff I'm doing. And I'm also posting some, you know, works in progress when I'm carving or drawing and stuff like that. So I know some people like to see that happen as well.
Amazing. And I'll include all that on the show notes.
Thanks.
So Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. That was fun.
Yeah, it was great to meet you.
All right, everyone. Till next time, keep exploring. Boom.